Hey folks, welcome to the show. It's been, I think, close to one and a half months now since we did an episode. We decided to take a season break of sorts.
And a timely one. Now we're back with the pipeline, and it's interesting that we'll be speaking to someone who's addressing the real estate space. And it's timely in the sense that we had some regulatory noise also coming out last week in terms of REITs and SM REITs and things like that. So I think we've timed it very well.
We have had regulatory noise on REITs. We have had regulatory noise with SEBI, with RBI. So yeah, I think the mood is that winters are over. Now it's time to get busy. And with that, I would like to welcome Shiv Parekh, founder and CEO of EdgeBits. Shiv, welcome to the show.
Hi, Nikhil. Great to be here. Hi, Sharad. Great to be here.
So, Shiv, EdgeBits is a fractional ownership platform. You're focused on commercial real estate. We've had, interestingly, property share on our show a few weeks back. So, we do probably have an initial primer into what you do. But yeah, just to kind of, you know, for the benefit of our listeners, if you can give a very, very quick download in terms of the primary offering of EdgeBits, maybe that can be a good starting point.
No, absolutely, Nikhil. So, you know, basically what we do is, you know, one line is we're looking to create the stock market of real estate in the sense that we want, you know, investors to be able to own shares in buildings and make the returns associated by, you know, owning a portion of a building. You know, the same way one can own a share of a Tata or a Reliance stock, why can't one own a share of a building in, say, a BKC or a Gurgaon or ORR in Bangalore? Our specific focus as of now, obviously, is commercial real estate. And when I say commercial, I mean office, warehouses, data centers, anything non-resi. And the reason for that is in commercial real estate, you have significantly better yields of 8 to 9% as opposed to resi where it's 2 to 3%. And you have, you know, grade A tenants who have long-term leases. So overall, as an investment option, it makes it more attractive. So that's, in a very quick nutshell, what we do. And obviously, it's completely tech-enabled for an investor.
Got it. So, I mean, I guess when it comes to the supply end, it's pretty clear. But on the demand end, I guess you break down the investment exposure needed, you know, at a much smaller level versus a typical real estate investment expectation of investors, right? I mean, I was reading that you have like average ticket size of like 25 to 30 lakhs. That's the kind of segment in which you can...
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. See, traditionally, you know, commercial offices were either bought by your global funds, whether a Blackstone or a Brookfield for thousands of crores, or then, you know, even one office unit would cost 20, 30, 50, 100 crore.
Right.
So out of the reach of most investors. And even if someone wanted to invest in a resi apartment as a, you know, as an investment option, that would still cost, you know, 50, 75, a couple of crore, or 50, 75 lakh. Here, yes, our minimum ticket size is 25 lakh. And like you mentioned in the intro, post the new regulation, the minimum ticket size is going to be 10 lakh. Cool. So it's coming down. And I think at some point it'll come down even further, but we're a few months or a year or so away from that.
Right.
And in terms of structuring, right, again, Shiv, just for the benefit of our listeners, when a new investor sort of comes in, he or she sort of mapped against a property and you sort of create a new SPV or a vehicle where that asset is sort of linked to every investor as a shareholder. Is that how it's sort of typically structured?
So again, there's the current structure and then there's going to be the structure post regulation, and I can explain more.
Yes.
So as of today, kind of what you mentioned is the way it operates. You know, every investor, every property is owned by an SPV, a special purpose vehicle, which is a private limited entity. And investors get shares and CCDs as per the amount that they are investing. So whatever rental comes in is paid out as interest on CCD. Mm-hmm. And then the appreciation of property is captured through the equity portion that they own.
Mm-hmm.
So separate SPV for every property. So that's the way it's, you know, currently structured.
Yeah.
Now with SEBI coming in, they've obviously it's going to be listed. They are going to structure it. They're proposing, as per the notification, it'll be structured as a trust.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And specific schemes in the trust will represent ownership in a specific SPV for a property. So high level, the only difference is now there's a layer of the trust between you and the SPV, you being the investor, and you will have units in the
trust. It's almost like a feeder fund which comes between...
Correct. But it's passed through, so there's no, you know, there's no additional tax implication per se. And the benefit is that it's listed, so there's a higher liquidity.
Right.
So that's
and just coming to that, right? I mean, when you look at a retail investor, I mean, you'd understand that better than anyone else. Is obviously there's an investor education element to making them understand what this product does and how you sort of how it makes sense to get exposure to real estate via these instruments. But a big question when you sort of draw panels with the stock market is liquidity. How do you sort of address the investor when he or she is sort of, you know, what is the typical length at which is there any lock-in? If not, like if I want to sell my position after 2 years, 3 years, how likely is that? And how does that work? Because that's one thing that investors often worry about, right?
No, obviously, getting in is relatively easy. Getting out is generally the hard part, and which is what we try to solve. So I won't say it's as liquid as, say, you list today and you're able to sell today. So it's not like a large cap stock with that level of liquidity. But so far, what we've seen already is that within 30 to 45 days, one is able to exit their share. If they listed on the platform.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just going to further expand, right? We already, so when someone lists today, we have 90,000 users on our platform. So it goes out to everyone. We have 1,000 channel partners that we work with. So that's just going to keep increasing. This market is going to keep increasing. So I believe that the liquidity will increase, or the time taken to exit will come further and further down. And being listed just, you know, adds to that, because now we'll probably have APIs with, you know, it'll be shown on a Zerodha or a Grow. So just the distribution expands tremendously. And then the ease of transaction is also much easier.
Yeah. Right.
And SEBI's coming down on the settlement time as well, right, for these transactions. Yeah. So it just expands the liquidity. So
interesting.
Your exit from a property, not at investor level, but if you sort of engage with the property, how do you look at that period? And what is the discipline there in terms, you know, trying to balance the capital appreciation versus liquidity?
Yeah. So generally, we look at the property in, you know, 4 to 6, 7 years is generally the sweet spot to exit a property where one can expect good capital appreciation. Reasons for that is obviously if properties appreciate over a longer period of time, your rental escalations generally are 15% every 3 years or 5% every year. So when it's a 15% every 3 years, you're only going to get a rental escalation then. And in terms of tax efficiency as well, your long-term capital gains kicks in after 3 years. So those are broadly kind of the parameters that, you know, generally the holding period is 4 to 6 or 7 years when we post which we look to exit the property.
You know, you were mentioning that you already have a captive secondary marketplace of sorts, right? Within your offering. You had that before SEBI came up with the... requirement of listing, etc. Now with the listing requirements coming in, would it be like would your internal secondary marketplace exist in parallel to the listed environment effectively, or would it get cannibalized by the listed ecosystem?
See, we don't make anything on the secondary, right? So for us, it's the idea is to just 45 days period that I spoke to you about, we want that to keep coming down if an investor wants to exit. Now how an investor discovers it, whether the discovery happens through our platform, whether it happens through, you know, maybe listed on a Zerodha or whatever, for us, it's completely fine. It's just expanding the universe of buyers. The actual transaction, obviously, even if it's through our platform, will ultimately happen on the exchange.
Right.
So our platform or any other platform is just a discovery mechanism for the final transaction to happen.
Understood. And if we want to let's look at a typical asset for you guys, right? Is it a Is it like a commercial tower? Is it like floors within a commercial tower? Because we have seen both those models exist, right? You also have parts of a structure which are often against whom pool of capital is raised, right? And they have their own set of challenges when it comes to maximizing IRRs. Often parts of a structure are not as attractive as the entire, right? How do you view these things internally at Edgebits?
Yeah, so one is we look at both parts of a structure as well as full structures.
Right.
And again, as per the new regulation, the limit is between 50 to 500 crore. Mm-hmm. So what you can get between 50 to 500 crore is either a floor or a few floors in a building,
right,
or a smaller building,
right,
traditionally at, in that range of 50 to 500 crore.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, whether we think a full building is better than just a floor in a building, I'd say that's one parameter over, the multiple other parameters that we look at.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when you acquire just a part in a building, there will be multiple other co-owners, right, who own other floors in the building. So you do have to see at that point, we do further due diligence into how the society or condominium is functioning, whether they have enough funds, whether, there's no dispute in the society. So those parameters do become important when you evaluate, floors in a building.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's one parameter that then we'll just go further deep dive. But if you look at it, 95% of residential real estate runs on a society and condominium structure.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some beautiful buildings across the country,
mm-hmm,
functioning perfectly fine.
I didn't mean more on the compliance end. I was thinking more from the standpoint of exit and from the standpoint of, deal dynamic. Like, for example, have you seen a delta in the performance of floors versus whole structures within the commercial real estate realm?
So traditionally, buildings that are strata sold have a slight discount in terms of rental,
right,
and in terms of capital value. But that means even at the entry point, you have the discount or the capital value.
Right.
And then generally tenants, depending upon, their preference, whether they're choosing a, fully owned building, they'll either value that or they'll value the lower pricing.
Mm.
So I think those dynamics come into play. Like, for instance, just to give an example, one asset we picked up was one floor in a 7-story building.
Right.
Tenant is ICICI Bank.
Hmm.
You can't get better than a bank as a tenant, right?
Right.
But they chose that because they were obviously prioritizing the specific location as well as cost that thing had to offer.
Yeah, no, sure. I was just sort of, I know you talked about rental yields on the commercial side, 8 to 10%. How much are we looking at in IRR terms? It's sort of 20%-ish in terms of general expectation.
So 20%, if I'm being honest, is at the higher end of the expectation.
Yeah.
I think conservatively, in the sense worst case scenario baseline, one can expect 13-14%.
Yeah.
Right. So 5-6% appreciation year on year is baseline because you're, rents generally appreciate 5% year on year, 15% every 3 years. Inflation is at that level.
You know, the commentary is so positive, right? When we look at this market, like people expect it to grow significantly by 2030 and assets under management needs to grow. If you can share, what is the current sort of traction in terms of assets under management that you guys are operating at? And I think ticket size is around 25 lakhs, as you alluded to. Where are we right now in the trajectory?
Yeah, so as of today, we have about 300 crore assets under management, and we are looking to scale that up pretty rapidly. We're looking to touch, say, 1,000 crore in the next 9 months, and then in the next 3 to 5 years, touch about 10,000 crore assets under management.
So I think you have recently launched an AIF as well, right?
Yes, we launched an AIF. There we are looking more at under construction properties.
Okay.
Right? That's the kind of mandate of the AIF.
What's your view on the, effectively, I think there is more and more formalization when it comes to real estate, right? Which kind of started probably half a decade ago. And with the recent rules, one is only going to see more and more conversion, right? And as a result of that, there's generally an interest in grade A commercial real estate. That's the one that everyone is targeting, be it traditional REITs as well as, players such as yourself, and it's converging. Post-COVID, there has always been there is a lot of, I would say, divergence in the view about, one is strictly from a, from a layman retail investor standpoint, in terms of office penetration, in terms of, you know, hybrid models, in terms of whether, you know, grade A commercial real estate, even a model worth pursuing, which might be an uninformed view. But on the other end, we see, you know, in terms of rentals, in terms of the velocity at which tenants are kind of coming in within greater real estate, the market is fairly brisk, right? Especially in those very tier one geographies and pockets of the country, correct? The central business districts in each large city, I think there is definitely a major supply demand gap which needs to be filled up, and that's how players such as, you know, developers as well as yourself are doing what you do. Can you give us like a 30,000 feet view from your standpoint in terms of how you see Indian commercial real estate evolve, especially within the grade A segment?
Yes, I think what you're referring to high level is what impact in a sense did this COVID have and, you know, to this office market and things like that. And I think that's a fair point from, you know, someone who's obviously not in the ecosystem. I think just a little bit overview, 2019 was one of the best years in, leasing in India prior to, you know, this thing. And then COVID happened. And then there was a question as to what's going to happen to commercial real estate. Are people going to, you know, work from office? Is it going to be work from home? And I think that the question mark was there in 20 and maybe 21. But I think post that, post COVID, I think the verdict of the jury is kind of, you know, it's decided that in India, work from home isn't really an option. And we can see that in the numbers, right? Like all cities are 80-90% back to office. Mm-hmm. I think the laggard a little bit, Bangalore is at 75% because they're a little bit more tech focused. But even recently in the news, you're seeing, you know, I think it was TCS or one of the large Indian outsourcing companies that said by March 31st, we're back to office. And I think the reason for that is relatively clear, right? India, I think two reasons. One is India obviously doesn't have the ecosystem to work from home, you know, internet issues, join families. So India is not really an ecosystem where people are able to work from home with the same level of productivity as say maybe in external countries, in other countries, Western countries. And in fact, in the what happened over, say, US, and just to add some color, about 85 or 80% of commercial real estate in India is leased by companies that are not Indian, that are, you know, externally headquartered companies. So what happened is that during COVID, a lot of these corporates, say a US-based corporate, so that, you know, if my employee is able to perform this job working from home, then I might as well outsource it to India. Mm. India's always been the central servicing hub of the country, of the world.
Right.
So in fact, in the last year, in 2023, we've seen a massive uptick in these global capability centers and outsourcing to India. Mm. In fact, because of COVID, because people realize that if people are able to work from home, then why can't they just work from India? But then in India, their office environment is still required, which is why I think 2023 has been a record year for office leasing. So that's a little bit about the, you know, dynamics. And because in 2020-2021 there was this uncertainty, no new commercial real estate was built.
But you have not seen any.
3 to 5 years is the cycle for, you know, full construction.
But you have not seen any structural change in the nature of the demand. Like, have you seen like grade A tenants ask for lesser floor space, or have the, you know, lease durations or the lock-in periods, have they dramatically changed? Because I imagine even in, you know, I mean, the GCC narrative that you have given is completely spot on. And I think India anyways, in the last 4 to 5 years has become like a hub for service-led manufacturing as well, which obviously requires a fair amount of outsourcing capability and manpower. But yeah, I mean, is there a change in terms of the base dynamic of demand?
Yeah, I think, see, there was, I think in 2022 and early 23, there was a structural change in terms of, you know, what the tenants were expecting. So, you know, a few of the things they wanted, you know, lesser lock-in, and they wanted the capex, you know, the internal office capex, the fit-out, which is always a negotiation point.
Mm-hmm.
The fit-outs being, you know, your plumbing, your electrical wiring within the office, the firefighting system, up to the level of your tables and chairs.
Right.
That's always a debate between the landlord and the tenant, who's going to put that capex. So, right after COVID, the tenants had the bargaining power.
Right.
So, it moved, you know, those deals that we saw then, the fit-outs, etc., were put on the landlord. But now what we've seen, you know, 2 years post-COVID, is that because what I was talking about, because now the supply is limited, the bargaining power is now shifting back. So, you know, rentals and prices are going higher in theory. That's just one example. BKC as well, you know, Prestige is expected, and Sumitomo Bank is expected to have new developments, but I think that's still 3, 4, 5 years away.
Hmm.
There's no new supply because no one invested in 2020, 2021.
Right. How do you square increasing interest rates with increasing rents here?
So, increasing interest rate, or right now, in my opinion, we've kind of...
We've hit the peak. But I mean, the rents have been increasing for the past, I would say, you know, 8 to 12 months, right?
Yeah, and I think rents, see, what happens is with increasing... The reason interest rates increase is because of inflation.
Yeah.
Right? And what the inflation means is that your cost of constructing a new building is higher because the price of steel, cement, and labor is going up. So any new supplier comes up, they'll need to even, you know, to break even on their projections, will need to charge a higher than, say, the market rent as of today because their cost of construction has gone up.
Right.
Which is why kind of, you know, that the rent has increased because of the rate in the interest rate or inflation increase as well.
I mean, one difference from a traditional real estate ownership is the, I mean, people are not going to go out for loans to buy a house like they do for a house in a SM REIT. I mean, they're not going to finance this through bank debt or anything like that, like typically. So, I mean, there is a little bit of an interest rate benefit there for the industry in a rising environment. People who can't afford houses might as well look for products like this to get real estate exposure. To, what is a typical investor like? Are you seeing a lot of international NRIs kind of folks sort of betting on the, who are not physically present in India, betting on such a macro bet? Or do you see a lot of domestic as well? I mean,
So absolutely. See, 30 to 35% of our investors are NRIs. Middle East, Southeast Asia, Europe, even US and Africa. And then in terms of the profile, it's mainly mid to senior level executives at, you know, MNCs, large Indian corporates, if they're from India.
Yeah.
And also then, you know, business owners, as well as professionals like chartered accountants, lawyers, doctors, military personnel. Yeah.
No, Shiv, I was wondering, like you mentioned a broad spectrum, you know, in terms of investors, you know, from a profile standpoint and from a geography standpoint. Like when one has to take real estate exposure, typically, I think location plays a fairly important role, right? In terms of familiarity. So like, for example, there's an NRI pitching him a grade A commercials structure in Bombay or Bangalore. Isn't that a tough sell in the sense that they probably have no idea of the market there, correct?
So I think that's where we come in, right? Where the kind of level and transparency we're providing on our dashboard to, you know, educate them firstly on market dynamics, on micro market dynamics of that city is where they get comfort.
That now we're talking about SM REIT as coming in, right? And people expect it to be a 5 billion AUM business 2030, 2033. You can see a lot more capital sort of being distributed now, right? Just because of how small the ticket size here is. So access is going to sort of really fuel it. Do you expect any further regulations that might come in terms of, or is there any regulations that you'd like to see come in?
No, see, just before that, I think you mentioned a very important thing, right? These Blackstone, Brookfields are making bets on the real estate market, and they've done very well. You know, even if the REITs have, you know, barely scratched the surface, right? Because, you know, if you look at the total grade A office space in India, it's 800 million square feet. This is grade A offices, which is in terms of value about 8 lakh crore. market cap of the three office REITs that are listed is about 55,000 crore. Even if you say one or two large players come up with additional REITs, that'll go from 55 to say 1,50,000 crore. So that leaves 6,50,000 crore of real estate where developers don't have an exit option except for ultra HNIs, which is not really an organized way of doing business or a market. And so that, those are the amount, you know, that's the quantum of assets that are, you know, for SM REITs. You know, and on the flip side, if you look at this, the REITs, the retail investor participation of the REITs, traditional REITs, is only 10,000 crore, which is tiny. Mutual fund is 50 lakh crore.
Yeah.
So, you know, REITs have not really been successful in driving retail investor participation on the other hand. And that's where, you know, that's the value add of SM REITs on both sides for the ecosystem.
Yeah.
But how would you gauge the performance of large REITs to date? You know, share in terms of from a market performance standpoint. Because, I mean, a lot of, there's been a lot of, I would say, regulatory to and fro from a taxation standpoint. Also, there have been things which have not been in its favor.
Yeah, I see. I think I think underlying assets that the REITs have are still very good. They're very good assets. And they are rented out assets. The only nuance, though, I would say is that for these REITs, the sponsors of those, the REITs, are the developers themselves.
Right.
So for them, their incentive has been just to list and then they get their exit, right? And the other thing is their focus hasn't been on driving the retail investor participation. And, you know, that's why they've not appreciated to the level that, you know, the underlying assets may have. And that's kind of why they've not done poorly by any means, but they've not done exceptionally well either.
Right. So within Edgebit, Shiv, what are your plans? I mean, you are obviously, like, you have done around, you know, 300 crores of AUM as we speak. You want to kind of triple it in the short to medium term. You're also setting up a separate AIF for under construction projects where you'll take a bit of development risk. What's the broad, you know, picture here in terms of your vision?
No, see, I think in terms of vision, you know, we are looking at, you know, across the spectrum of real estate, right? Whether it's under construction, pre-leased. And obviously the hope is that at some point this ticket size of 10 lakh will come down further, which Mrs. Madhvi Puri Butch did mention in her, you know, initial board meeting speech in November that, you know, at 10 lakh is the starting point. It will come down further as trust is built in the ecosystem. So vision is really, like I said at the start, to create the stock market of real estate. And stock market also has, you know, good assets as well as liquidity. And that will increase as the overall ecosystem and as our AUM increases and as more people become aware of this investment option.
Right.
I think that's what our vision is.
But, you know, I mean, if you just kind of flip the equation for a minute, I mean, I totally understand, you know, the point that you made in terms of the inventory out there and the low penetration of REITs within that specific inventory, as well as from the standpoint of retail participation. But there's always a counter narrative, right? That the retail market in India is really overplayed, right? I mean, effectively in terms of share of wallet, you know, everyone is really, you know, fighting for the same set of 70, 80 million people. What do you say to that? Or is your bet on the fact that the churn or the conversion from the aspirational Indian or the Indian below that to a superior class of retail investor will compensate for the small size that we have as of now? Because, you know, there's been some interesting data points, right? I mean, like Bloom came out with a report recently where, you know, they were making the point that effectively there are, you know, there are only 45 lakh taxpayers who are responsible for 80% of tax accruals in the country, right? And if you look at people who are actually filing tax returns, I think that number was 22 million, right? If you look at the number of DMAT account holders, that's probably like 80 or 90 million, right? Those are small numbers, right, at the end of the day. So what's your view on that?
So I agree with, I can't dispute the data, but my judgment is that that number in itself is not small, right? 80 to 90 million, while small as a percentage of the Indian population, right? 10% or 8%. In terms of volume, 80 to 90 million is still an extremely large number. right? And obviously, India in itself is growing. So that share will increase. That 80 to 90 million is anyways increasing. But even if I look at this 80 to 90 million that you mentioned, that in, one that in itself is large. Number two is that, you know, if there's certain other data where if you look at 50% of Indian household wealth is in real estate. And that's not your primary residence. That's, you know, could be a second apartment that you invested in. So that's the share of wallet one that we are looking to capture. Other is obviously the amount that's invested in, say, gold or FDs. That's the amount we are looking to capture. Even from this 80 to 90 million Indians that we're talking about.
Interesting. So, I mean, because I mean, there, I mean, it's almost become like financial markets also is becoming a game of, I don't know, I won't say it's a game of eyeballs, but effectively, you know, there are those 7-8 options. All of them are getting fractionalized as we speak. So there is a lot of internal churn and realignment also, which is expected there, correct? And I guess real estate always had the, has that kind of classic legacy appeal as something stable yield earning to make it attractive.
Yeah. See, what I would say though, in my opinion, is that if you look at, see, above 50 lakh in 1 crore in the financial market, there are a lot of investment options, right? PMSs, structured products through the AIF route. But at, you know, at 10 or 25 lakh ticket sizes, there are actually very few options for one to invest. I mean, mutual fund from a financial perspective, it's either mutual fund or gold. Or you know, FDs at a high level. That's kind of it. There's not too much else that one can invest in. So this is also providing the diversification play. While I believe that mutual funds also is a good option and will continue growing, and it's grown extremely well in the last few years. The penetration of that is still about 3%. So that will grow as well. I think overall we're seeing a lot of buoyancy in the market, right, and the growth of the market.
And what's the role of advisory here? Because, I mean, I understand that you want to be tech-enabled. You are you provide a fair amount of transparency, dashboarding to all your investors so they can literally see which asset their money is pooled in, how the, you know, what's the kind of leasing behavior, leasing performance that's going out. But in terms of, from the standpoint of, you know, customer acquisition, I imagine, is that still fairly automated, or there is a lot of manual heavy lifting required? Because even if, you know, I feel that any check beyond like a couple of thousand is where someone wants some sort of a human interface on the other end.
No, I completely agree. So in fact, even, you know, customers that visit our dashboard and, you know, have all the information, the final, you know, investment happens after they speak either to our RMs. Or to advisors, partners that we work with. So advisors, partners are an important part of our ecosystem as well. Because a lot of times, you know, an investor might have a pre-existing relation with a specific advisor who they trust. So for us, it's not to eliminate the advisor, it's to work with the advisor, because a lot of this knowledge that advisors have is based on, you know, 10, 20, 30 years of experience being in the industry. And in fact, advisors, because they are in this day in and day out for the last 20 years, give us a lot of feedback into, you know, these are the kind of products you should look out for. This is the kind of risk profile investors like. So they give us a lot of market feedback as well. And in fact, on the tech side, we are building, we have a platform for advisors as well to enable them to, you know, learn and, you know, work with their investors after that.
And is the question, like now I think things are different with SME REITs coming into the picture, right? I mean, there is a formalized trust structure. It will probably be more heavily regulated than it used to be earlier. But in your early days, you know, things like, for example, if I'm an investor, what's my legal claim or title of a fractional share of a property, right? I mean, how does that dynamic work? I mean, till rents are coming in on time and I'm getting exit, I think no one complains. But if, say, there is some sort of a distress or a default event, then obviously the question around the legal claim or title of a unit comes into the picture. So before this entire trust mechanism came into the, into the framework, thanks to developments which happened over the last few weeks, was that even a concern?
No, I mean, in a sense, it's a legitimate question, but we address that. Obviously, a very important question, but we address that in the sense that you know, every SPV is owning that asset.
Right.
The investors, all the investors are the ones who are shareholders in that SPV.
Right.
So, you know, through that route, they are the end owner of the asset.
Right.
And any decision making with regards to asset was up to the group of investors, obviously. And the title, we verify from a tier one law firm, right? So right now we work with Shardul Amachal Mangal Das. So the title is ensured that it's verified by a tier one law firm.
Right.
And the ownership rests in that SPV where the investors themselves are the shareholders.
Right. No, thanks. Thanks, Shiv. This was super helpful and fascinating. And, you know, I think you're bang on the target when you said that we have barely scratched the surface. I mean, we have kind of in the last decade, seen the shift from physical real estate towards, you know, looking at real estate as a financial product or a financial asset class. And I think things can only go upward from there. Formalization is something me and Sharad are a big fan of. So we'll be, you know, cheering for you on the sidelines and watch as you crack larger and more significant milestones in the future. With that, this is Nikhil Arora and I have with me Sharad Tupran signing off.